Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Family Ties by B. R. Kingsolver. Narrated by Siobhan Waring. Chapter 1. Closing up one evening, trying to get out early to meet up with friend in Dublin, I started toward the front door of my stall to roll down the metal door. At that moment, a man strolled in, head swivelling about, looking at the pictures of my work on the walls and then leaning over the display cases. My inventory was very low, with one sword, two knives and a few pieces of jewellery the only things available. "As you can see," I said, "I don't have much in stock at the moment." He shook his head.
"I'm actually looking to have something custom made. A sword."
I surveyed him. His hair was grey and receding. He was about my height, and although he appeared to have once been athletic, he was gaining weight with age. I didn't recognise his clothing, but the fabrics were rich. The colours bright, the seams tight. The leather of his boots was shined, smooth and clean. "I do make custom swords," I said, "but I'm closing up for the day. Come after midday tomorrow and I'll record your requirements. I require payment of half in advance for custom work."
"I'm leaving tonight," he said. "I'll be back in 30 days and would like to pick up the sword then."
He pulled a cloth bag from an inside pocket of his cloak and poured the contents into a shallow dish on the counter. The rubies range from the size of my thumbnail down to the size of the nail on my smallest finger. The diamonds ran from 1/3 to 0.5 carat. I picked up the largest ruby, and my magic told me it was real. 14 rubies and 42 diamonds. Rubies were not only valuable as gemstones, but they were used as focus points to concentrate magic. Just as they were used for lasers in technological worlds, they were used in magical worlds for the same purpose. I gave him a questioning look.
"I need a dress sword, but I want it functional if need be."
He gestured to the sword in the display case.
"Fancier than that. Slimmer. Gold and silver settings for the stones, both on the hilt and the scabbard. Take the gems you need for your payment, and set the rest."
My own weapons were set with rubies, although not as large or as many as the gentleman's sword would hold. I always carried them with me when I travelled, just in case. "Straight or curved?" I asked. "Single or double-edged? Are you right or left-handed, and on which side do you plan to wear it? Length?" He knew what he wanted, so I quickly recorded his specifications. A lump of soft clay provided the size of his hand, and another the size and dimensions of the hilt he desired. When we finished, I separated out 6 rubies and 12 diamonds. "That will be my payment," I said.
30 days?
"It will be ready for you." I pushed a card toward him. "If I am not here when you come, check with this man. He will be able to give you the sword." I held up 2 tokens, gave him one, and dropped the other into the bag of gemstones.
"And if I'm not happy with it?"
With a shrug, I said, "Whether I'm here or not, if you aren't happy with it, I'll make you another." I looked him in the eyes. "And you'll pay for the second one as well. Wear the first one, give it as a present, throw it in the river. It's all the same to me. It's not like a new cloak, I can't adjust it once it's finished." I gestured to the pictures on the wall. "My work. I assume you've inquired about me before walking in here with a fortune in jewels?" He nodded, turned, and walked out into the street. He turned to the right, the air shimmered, and he disappeared. A walker! There weren't too many people who could walk between worlds, and even fewer were completely human. I took the bag of gemstones to the back and placed them in my safe, then locked it and sealed it magically. Hearing a noise from the front, I realised I hadn't closed and locked the door. I hurried toward it, but slowed, as I saw a man standing in the shop, staring at me across the counter. "I'm closing," I said. "You'll have to come back tomorrow."
"Diana Smith?"
he asked, his voice a deep growl. In contrast to my previous visitor, he was rough-looking. He had several days' growth of beard, and straggly brown hair framed his face under a battered, broad-brimmed hat. The duster he wore over his clothes was stained, and had seen better days. His eyes were hard, the lines of his face set. "Yes?" I said, palming a knife lying on the table next to me. His right hand came up and I saw a pistol. The knife flew from my hand and hit him in the chest, the crossbow bolt from his pistol embedded into a table leg to my left. The man took a shuffling step backwards into the door jamb and dropped the crossbow. I rushed around the counter and slammed my forearm into his throat. With my other hand I triggered the overhead door to drop.
"You're going to die,"
I said through gritted teeth.
You can die quickly or slowly and painfully. Who sent you?
I think he must have felt his lifeblood draining away, because I saw the fear in his eyes. The knife had been a lucky toss, missing bone and burying itself in his heart.
Believe me, I'm a mage. I can keep you alive for days, but you won't enjoy it.
Schleckig, he croaked.
To most people, even in the marketplace, the word wouldn't have meant a thing, or even been recognised as a word. I pulled the knife from his chest and drew it across his throat, then jumped back. I managed to avoid most of the blood spray, as well as his body falling to the floor. I quickly locked the door and set a magical ward, then trotted to the back of the shop and pulled a canvas tarp from a shelf in the storeroom. I rolled the body onto the tarp and searched through the assassin's pockets. It didn't have any identification, which I expected, only the entrance pass for the marketplace and a key for a hotel room in Erie City, outside the marketplace boundaries. There were also at least half a dozen different kinds of weapons, a butane lighter and a package of Earth cigarettes. That didn't mean he was from Earth, as I could buy that brand and the lighter at dozens of stalls in the marketplace in the world of Irilor. I cast a spell to clean up the blood and glanced at my chrono, which gave me the time and day of the marketplace and the time and day of my home city in Earth. I needed to dump the body, but I figured I might still be able to meet my friends for dinner. I was the oldest of three, triplets, born in the bucolic world of Tilandra. Like my siblings, I trained as a smith when I was young. It was an honourable profession, handed down to us by our father. He had a smith's magic which we inherited, but we were different, as he married an elven mage. In addition to working with metals and various kinds of engines, we also learned to craft wood, and wands, and wards, and magical means of transportation. We inherited our mother's ability to walk between worlds, and so she first took us to see the great marketplace at the crossroads of the worlds when we were very young. I was entranced, enthralled, and never got over the wonder I felt the first time I walked into that glorious, colourful, exciting, noisy, raucous, confusing, smelly and bewitching place. I was restless, a wanderer, and spent more than 2 decades travelling the worlds. One night, in a tavern in the great marketplace, a merchant put up his stall in the marketplace as stakes in a card game. I wanted that particular stall, and its forge, very badly, so I cheated and won. I never felt guilty. If you're a fool with a weakness for drink, sooner or later someone will take advantage of you. Just as a warning, don't gamble with a mage. The great marketplace was open 27 hours of the Irilorian day, every day. Its size and shape were constantly changing, but in general, it was about 9 kilometres square, on 3 levels. Livestock and live animal dealers clustered at the south end on the west side. Tanners, leather workers and metal workers' shops were north of there. Since I mostly ran the shop by myself, customers had to catch me when they could. Even when I was there, I didn't always respond to customers stopping by. Hammering on a sword or pouring white-hot liquid metal into a mould were activities that didn't lend themselves to interruptions. But my reputation for craftsmanship spread, and I didn't lack for customers. Chapter 2. My original plan of going home, taking a shower and dressing in something sexy to go out was shot. I did have a small apartment with a toilet and a shower in the back of the shop. Metalwork isn't the cleanest profession, and I often cleaned up prior to leaving. My smithing clothes, brown and black leather, thick enough to provide protection from melting steel, didn't exactly coincide with Dublin fashion at the time, and usually I wasn't concerned with cleaning up blood. After washing myself, I checked the apartment's small closet and found some decent clothes. Bra and panties, a thin ribbed V-neck grey pullover, black tights, a darker grey wool skirt that hit me a little lower than mid-thigh, and ankle boots. Perfectly fine for a Friday night out in Dublin. I tied a rope around the tarp, then cast a spell to float it off the floor. Heading toward the back of the shop, towing the body behind me, I pushed against the veil and walked through a silvery shimmer in the air into another world, another dimension. I had heard it debated, but never heard a definitive number, as to how many worlds existed in the universe. Most people never experienced a world other than the one where they were born, but some mages could feel the veils that separated the worlds. I only had to extend my consciousness, feel the veil, then push on it with my magic. It would part, and I would walk through it into another world, sometimes similar to Earth, or Irilor, or my native Tilandra.
but some worlds were very alien and ruled by creatures who weren't human. After more such transitions and a 2-mile hike, I stood in the middle of a forest at the base of a hill covered in loose rock. Black sky and sharp white stars overhead, along with a slight breeze, were as far from the hustle of the great marketplace as one could get. Pulling my burden behind me, I climbed up the hill. 2/3 of the way to the top, I pulled a dead tree and a couple of small boulders out of the way, dissolved the illusion spell, and revealed the entrance to a cave. I had discovered the place more than 20 years before, and the visitor that evening would be the 3rd body I'd dumped there. I dragged the body into the cave and dropped it into a deep hole in a branch to the left. Walking back out into the moonlight, I hid the entrance again. Another cave in the area had also occasionally served me as a place to hide. I was 150 kilometres from the nearest road, the nearest town, in a part of a world that was lightly settled. It was my personal hiding place, a rural world with only basic technology and basic magic. A place no one paid attention to, and where no one would ever look for me. Taking stock of my hair and clothing, I decided I was still presentable. Instead of going back to the marketplace, I took a shorter route. I walked through 2 worlds, and the 3rd crossing put me in the churchyard of Christ Church Cathedral in Dublin. It was dark and late enough that there wasn't anyone around to see me appear, and early enough that there weren't any drunks staggering past. It took my eyes a minute to adjust when I walked into the pub. Then I saw Donnie getting up from a table across the room and waving at me. I smiled and waved back and went up to the bar. "A Smithix and a shot of Redbreast," I told the barman. "Maybe make it a double."
"Rough week."
"Rough day." Realising I hadn't eaten since breakfast, I said, "And a chicken pot pie, if you please."
"Sure. Where are you sitting?"
I pointed. "With Donnie."
"I'll have someone bring it out to you."
He gave me my beer and whiskey, and I paid him and made my way across the room. A group of people, including Donnie and Siobhan, my closest friends, sat around the table, and the empty glasses and plates let me know they had been there for a while. They were all single young professionals, about 20 to 25 years younger than I was. I looked about their ages due to my elven heritage. "Sorry I'm late. I couldn't get away tonight," I said. "Don't you hate that?" Siobhan said. "Especially on Friday. My boss doesn't want to go home to his wife, so he thinks everyone else wants to hang out with him." "These were clients," I said, downing a slug of whiskey and chasing it with a deep drink of beer. "One of them was important to take care of, but the other guy was a complete waste of time. My friends thought that I worked for an international logistics consulting company. It covered my frequent travel and prolonged absences. Earth was among a number of worlds where most of the people had no awareness of magic or of other worlds. But when I acquired the stall at the marketplace, I decided to settle down and bought a condo in Dublin centre. It gave me a place to hang my clothes, an address to send my mobile phone bill to, and a bug-free mattress that was comfortable. There were other worlds I could have settled in, but Ireland was a friendly place. The food was good, and it was beautiful. In 12 years, I'd never had an assassin come looking for me there either. The conversation I interrupted had to do with plans for the weekend.
"I'm off to France in the morning," Donnie said. "Want to come with me?"
I shook my head. "I wish, but I need to visit my mother this weekend."
"In the States?"
Saoirse asked.
"Yes." "Isn't that a long trip, just for a weekend?"
With a shrug, I said, "Yes, but that's where she is. I have business there next week, so I can have my company pay for the flight and get a chance to spend some time with her." That was something everyone understood, and it also set me up for the prolonged absence I suspected was coming. If someone wanted me dead, I couldn't just ignore it. Of course, no one on Earth knew about the marketplace or other dimensions, let alone that I was a walker. But I knew from experience that if I just disappeared, my friends in Earth worried. Normal people didn't wander off for months at a time, I guess. In my family, if I didn't hear from someone for a couple of years, I assumed they were doing well, having a good time, and didn't need me to help bail them out. It had actually been more than a year since I last saw my parents, and no one, to my knowledge, had invented a device that could communicate across dimensions. I did subscribe to a service that transported birthday cards to my parents and siblings, assuming they let me know if and when they moved, but it was automatic and paid years in advance. About the time my pot pie arrived, a group of musicians struck up a song. There really wasn't room to dance, but it being Ireland, a couple of people cleared a small space and put on an exhibition. The crack was flowing. A A young man, evidently a friend of Siobhan or one of her co-workers, joined us and did his damnest to talk me into dancing. Since I wasn't Irish and had never pretended to be, I didn't take the bait. I was fast on my feet, but not that fast. I was more tempted when he tried to talk me into going home with him, but in the end, I left the pub alone. It wasn't too late, so there were plenty of people out on the street. One of the nice things about Dublin was that a woman might have a slight worry about getting raped or mugged, but the chances of meeting world-walking assassins, being kidnapped for ransom, being waylaid by an evil sorcerer trying to steal my magic, or falling in a battle due to marauding bands of out-of-work mercenaries were negligible. A boring country, Ireland. Just the way I liked it. But before I went home, I needed to check something out. I stepped into a dark alley, felt for the veil, and pushed with my magic. A silvery shimmer appeared in the air, and I walked through two worlds into Eerie City in Irrilor. Once I got my bearings and understood where I had appeared, I went looking for my assailant's inn. It wasn't one of the nicer places to rent a room, so it wasn't one that many of my clients tended to frequent. I found it, slipped into the common room, and ordered a pint from the barman. The ale was swill, so I quickly set it on a table in a dark corner and headed for the woman's water closet. I waited for a short while, then kept to the common room's shadows as I took the stairs to the third floor. I used his key to enter a small room with little more than a bed, a wardrobe, and a water closet with a sink. I searched the place and found a few things I thought might be of interest, including a short letter in handwriting similar to my mother's. My dead assailant had some identification, but someone would have to work hard to convince me it was legitimate. I pocketed a bag full of gold and silver coins from my mother's homeworld that was hidden under the mattress, then went out the window and floated to the street below. I walked out of that world before I reached the end of the alley. My apartment in Dublin overlooked a street with a couple of pubs, a couple of boutiques, a lovely tea shop for breakfast, and had a view of St. Stephen's Green out one window. The shop below me was owned by a tailor, a funny and kind old man named Liam. I'd bought the apartment from him and renovated it years before. The front entranceway had the door to his shop on the right and the door to my stairs on the left. I also had a back door and a flight of stairs down to the alley. I packed a small backpack as an overnight bag, set an alarm for the crack of dawn, and fell into bed. Chapter 3. Another reason I had chosen Ireland for a base of operations was that the village in the world where my parents lived was an easy walk from the centre of the island. With a cup of takeout coffee in hand, I took the bus out the Galway Road to Kinnegad, a nice little town in the middle of nowhere. I had breakfast at a local cafe, then struck out on foot into farm country. My third dimension transition brought me out on a dirt road where I caught a ride with a farmer driving a wagon pulled by two horses. He knew my parents, and he knew me and my siblings, so he filled me in on the important local gossip and dropped me off by my front gate. Our house was on the edge of town, and I could see the Lord's Keep in the distance. Someone was hammering on steel off to the left and behind the house, so I wandered back there. "Are you sure you have that shoe hot enough?" I called. My father was in the process of shoeing a white horse tied next to an anvil in a small forge. I had heard him ask me that question hundreds of times when I was growing up. He left off what he was doing, straightened, and said with a grin,
"Aye, and I'll not be having a snot-nosed little girl telling me my business."
I skipped towards him and into his arms. His hug was almost enough to crush my ribs. I noted that a little bit of white was creeping into his hair and beard, but his blue eyes still held the sparkle they always had when he looked at me.
"So what are you doing home?"
he asked.
"Burn down the rest of the world and this is the only safe place to hide out?"
"Something like that. Is Mum in the house?"
"Baking cookies. She must have seen you were coming."
"Well, I better go and get my share before you finish here, shouldn't I?"
"Better hurry. This is the last show for this old girl."
I entered the house through the back door and the smell of fresh baked cookies filled my nose. "Let them cool a few minutes, Diana," Mum called. Her back was to me, and she was bent over pulling a second sheet of cookies out of the oven. I reached out and touched one of the cookies on the tray on the table, quickly pulling my hand back and sticking my finger in my mouth. She turned, dropped the second tray on the table, and smirked at me, trying to cool my finger. "You're as bad as your father. Neither one of you ever listens." Then she threw her arms wide, and I stepped into her hug. "Dad said you knew I was coming." She shrugged, pulled away from me and poured me a cup of tea. Although she was older than my father, she didn't look much different than she did when I was young. Elves lived a long time. "Sit. I've been having uneasy feelings and you're the closest. Sometimes I think your brother and sister are oblivious to what's going on around them. I handed her a bag of herbs and spices and a smaller bag of candy from Galandril, her home world. Both were easily available in the marketplace. Then I sat down. I see, I said. And what might be going on in the library? Someone accidentally tear a page? Your sister doesn't completely live in a bubble. The outside intrudes there, just as it does other places. And unless it makes a sound as loud as a bomb, she's unlikely to notice, I said. Taking a sip of my tea, I ventured to try and pick up the cookie again. It was cool enough to take a bite, so I did. Mum, some fool came to my shop in the marketplace and tried to kill me.
Obviously, he failed.
He said Schleckek hired him.
She froze, then slowly turned toward me and lowered herself into the chair across the table.
Oh, my. And you believe him? He had no reason to lie. He was dying, and I certainly didn't suggest that name. Took me completely by surprise. Hell, I would have guessed a dozen other people I've pissed off before I even thought about my darling relatives.
Mum nodded. Did you say anything to your father about this?
I shook my head. Happened yesterday. Figured I'd come to talk to you before I contacted Karina and Bjorn. Have you seen either of them recently?
No. The three of you came 3 years ago for your father's birthday, and you're the only one I've seen since.
I've always been your most loving and devoted daughter.
Also, the one who had organised our visit for that birthday.
You've always been my biggest problem, child. That's because Karina never got caught.
And how does that negate what I said?
Is grandfather in ill health?
Not that I've heard. You think this is about the succession? I renounced that long ago.
But not for us. Where are we in all that?
It would have been wrong to make choices for you before you were even born.
Her eyes drifted up to the ceiling, and she got a faraway expression on her face.
You're seventh, I think. I haven't thought about that in decades.
If I was seventh, then Karina was eighth, and Bjorn ninth. Well, Bjorn has his own problems, and Karina has arranged things so she has none, I said. I guess that makes me the obvious troublemaker who will want to disrupt a clan I know nothing about.
If they knew you better, they would understand you've spent your life running away from responsibility, she said.
I realised with a start that it had been 12 years since I'd visited my mother's homeworld. I'd run into a couple of my cousins in various places, but always by accident. Aunt Shilvana dropped into my shop a few years ago. She wasn't particularly sweet. I can't imagine why I would want to spend more time with any of them.
They are very wealthy. As if that would concern me. As I said, they don't know you. People who value possessions don't understand those who don't.
All the more reason to want to kill me, I guess. Honestly, Mum, I've racked my brain, and I can't think of anything else. But that's what the assassin said. Schleckek.
That was the name of my mother's clan, headed by her father, an elven royal. When he discovered that she was pregnant by a common smith from a backwards world with little magic, he threatened to disown her. She did him one better, renouncing her heritage and marrying my father. And she wondered where Karina and I got our attitudes.
Are you sure he was an assassin and not just a bill collector? She asked. The crossbow bolt embedded in one of my tables sort of ruled out a social call. Recognise the handwriting? I asked, pushing across the table the letter and a couple of coins that I'd taken from the assassin's room.
She pursed her lips, then took a deep breath.
Not really. Do you know what language that is? Felowin. It's the lingua franca of the marketplace. It's not so much a fully developed language as pidgin speech. It's not even spoken in most of Irulor away from the marketplace, but across the world, most merchants and caravanners use it.
Mum nodded. The coins, of course, are elven from Galandril.
Do you recognise your great-grandmother?
She meant the image of a woman with pointed ears on the coins.
Not really. She died before I was born, remember?
Were there enough of them to pay for an assassination?
About 40 gold and 100 silver. Personally, I consider my life worth more than that.
I'm sure your assassin would probably agree with you. It definitely didn't cover his risk. Put all that away. Here comes your father.
I helped her fix dinner. We had cookies for dessert. Then we played Lessendern, a game similar to multi-person chess that my father was fond of. It had been more than 30 years since I left home, but my bed that night still felt more comfortable than any bed I'd ever slept in.
Chapter 4. After walking back to Earth, then to Irulor, I spent the following week working during the day on the sword for the enigmatic gentleman with the rubies. and in the evenings I wound flat gold wire on a set of jigs to make filigreed settings for the rubies I had taken in payment. Although normally I was careful of my surroundings, I found myself constantly looking over my shoulder. I shielded myself and varied my routes between the shop and my home, but it always felt as though I was being watched. If so, I never caught my shadow. Paranoid was definitely my middle name. I sent word to Hassan, a human friend from Irilor who had a stall in another part of the market, to meet me for lunch. We met at a tavern that had private, magically shielded rooms. The proprietor was of a race that was very scary, though I had never met anyone who knew her homeworld. "I have to go away for a while. Family business," I told Hassan. "I have a sword that a customer expects to pick up, and I'm not sure when I'll be back. I gave him your card, and he will have a match to this token." I handed him the token, a polished black stone with red inclusions, and the smallest ruby. "For your trouble." It wasn't an unusual request, and Hassan nodded as he made the token and ruby disappear.
"Just the one customer?"
"Yes, business has been slow, and I have been lazy. If anyone asks about me, you haven't seen me, and thought I should be open as always."
"She hasn't been around," he said, his eyebrows raised. "I don't know. A new lover, perhaps?"
I chuckled. I wish it was something that pleasurable. But no one should be asking. Be wary of anyone who shows too much interest. When I finished the sword and necklace, I dropped the sword off with Hassan as he was closing one evening. His shop was known for unique clothing, so I bought several embroidered blouses from him and tucked them away in my pack. Then I slipped out of the market and walked to Ireland in Earth. A ferry took me across to England, and I bought a train ticket to London and then to Cambridge. From there, I walked into Verdun, the world of the Great Library. The geography didn't always coincide from world to world, and the means of transportation definitely didn't. As a result, one often had to take circuitous routes to reach a destination, or sometimes the trips were quite short. The caravan routes were always available, but usually they were much longer than I could manage travelling on my own. The world of Verdun had a transportation system as extensive as that of Earth, although very different. The airships reminded me of something out of a steampunk novel that used a combination of magic, helium, and steam. Steam-driven trains and automobiles were very common, but personal cars were so expensive that only the very wealthy could afford them. The city of Camlin sat on the coast. It was a large port for trade as well as for fishing. Turning away from the sea, I could see tall white-capped mountains in the distance, which immediately reminded me that I wasn't in England anymore. What made Camlin famous, not just in the world of Verdun, but in all of the worlds, was the bridge that arced out from the shore to the large tidal island 3 kilometres offshore. At first glance, the conical island resembled Le Mont-Saint-Michel off the Normandy coast in Earth. But it wasn't a medieval palace or a Catholic abbey, and it was larger. The Great Library occupied the entire island, which was about 3 square kilometres in area and 200 metres high. The whole island was honeycombed with tunnels and caverns, and the scholars had drilled deep into the bedrock more than a dozen levels below the seafloor. Karina had been accepted to study there when we turned 18. She was now a senior scholar and had never lived anywhere else. She had travelled extensively and probably seen more worlds than I had, but her visits were almost always involved with her studies and research. I took a bus across the bridge, and it let me off at the western gate. I showed the guards the special token I had, and they allowed me in with all my weaponry. It had been years since I visited the library, but the magical token still provided me access, as well as letting me know that my sister still lived. If she died, the token would go dark and silent. I wore it on a chain around my neck, set in a pendant Karina had made, and it had never been out of my possession since she gave it to me. The library was a town unto itself, built entirely of stone, with narrow, winding lanes. Most of the buildings around the edges, at the lowest open-air levels, were 3 to 5 stories tall. At ground level there were some shops and taverns. All of the owners of such establishments were relatives or descendants of scholars. No one, from outside, could start or buy a business there. But there were few businesses other than the food shops. Most of the island's inhabitants shopped either in Camlin or Lestrasia, the city 5 kilometres away on the eastern continent. No vehicles or burden beasts were allowed on the island. As I climbed the streets to where Karina lived, I reflected that all of the island's inhabitants had to be in excellent physical shape. I finally reached the small park I sought on the third level. The fountain in the centre bubbled and splashed and sparkled in the sunlight. Birds in the trees sang with joyful welcome. I looked up to the third-floor balcony of my sister's apartment, but no one was there. I would have much rather sat there with a cup of tea and a plate of cookies on such a splendid morning, but I assumed Karina was buried deep in the library, her nose in a book.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?